It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. For well over 150 years, debtors' prisons have been illegal in the United States. But that restriction only applies to private debts. In practice, public fines and court debts can be another story. In a study published last fall, between 25 and 2018, 8,000 residents of Wisconsin were jailed each year for failure to pay those kind of fines and debts. Our next guest will walk us through the causes and consequences of what some people are calling modern-day debt imprisonment in our justice system. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever spent time in jail for failing or being unable to pay a traffic fine or a court fee? Have you been threatened with jail time but found a way to pay? Do you have questions about this process? Do you think people should spend time behind bars for failure to pay these fees and fines? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. John Gross is a clinical associate professor of law at the University of Wisconsin Law School and director of the Public Defender Project. John, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Before we turn to these public debts and fines and fees, you read old time stuff, people end up in debtors' prisons all the time way back in the day. Can you talk about the legal landscape now when it comes to private debt? In general, people don't end up in prison for that.
That's correct. We no longer rely on debtors' prisons. We have bankruptcy proceedings. The same is not always true in criminal courts. There's a lot of mandatory fees and fines that are imposed on people. People often have to pay costs associated with their own probationary sentence, their own monitoring. And if people don't pay some of those fees and fines, they can find themselves back in court and threatened with imprisonment.
Can you talk about the variety of either fines, I think include traffic tickets, and court fees that end up being part of this story?
Sure. There's a lot of different costs associated with even a minor trip through the criminal system, the criminal legal system. If you get a ticket, there are all sorts of fees and fines associated with it. Those fines and fees go to different government agencies. If you wind up being convicted of a crime, there are often mandatory court costs imposed. The state can actually charge you fees. If you had a lawyer appointed to your case, they can demand that you pay restitution. And so there's many, many different ways that people can find themselves with debt associated with everything from a relatively minor traffic ticket to a more serious charge that's adjudicated in a criminal court.
Talk us through then what leads to having those fines or court fees in place and then ending up in jail. As I mentioned, a report found 8,000 Wisconsinites per year, roughly over a long period, ending up in jail.
So the legislature has elected to impose mandatory fees when people are convicted of crimes, with the idea that it's both sort of a punishment, but also a way to help fund the criminal justice system that is adjudicating these cases. And so, and oftentimes those fees are not nominal, they're not minimal, they can be $400, $500, or $600. And most people in the country can't afford an emergency payment of more than $500. So people find themselves in debt to the court. Some courts, I think, smartly don't try to enforce that debt. But others do, and they do by issuing a warrant to have the person arrested for non-payment and brought back before a judge.
Are they then subject to more court fees since they're appearing in court again?
This can often lead to a cycle of debt. This is especially true of traffic offenses where, if you get a fine or a fee for speeding and you don't pay it, your license will then be suspended. And to get your license reinstated, you'll have to pay additional fees. And if you get another ticket, there's additional fees on that because now you have a suspended license and you're maybe still driving because you have to get to work or pick up your kids. And so people can really get caught in this spiral of debt related to just really minor infractions. Traffic tickets can lead to sizable debts for folks. And it winds up being a sort of hole that they can't dig themselves out of.
So if I, say, owe a court $500, just pick a number, and I can't pay it for whatever reason, so it goes through this process, I'm back in court, I'm sent to jail, what happens then? Is the fine waived? Is it per day you waive so much? What happens to my debt whilst I'm sitting in jail?
So I should say that before a judge can jail someone for non-payment of a fine, a fee, a court cost, or restitution, a judge first has to make a determination about whether or not the person actually can pay. Because we don't have debtors' prisons. And the problem arises when judges, frankly, don't do this. You can imprison someone who willfully fails to pay a debt owed to the court. It's a form of contempt of court. But if the person doesn't have the money, the Constitution and the Supreme Court has made it very clear, you can't put the person in jail. But oftentimes people don't know that. People don't have lawyers representing them because they're too poor to pay the fine. And judges don't always take the time to figure this out. And so people can indeed sit in jail when a judge has ordered that if the fine is paid, they'd be released. But there's no one to pay the fine.
Talking to John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the University of Wisconsin Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project, talking about what some call, in effect, a modern-day system of debt imprisonment. But when it comes to debts for courts and fines, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions based on what you've heard so far or opinions? Maybe you've got an experience of your own to share. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, is there an official guideline or system for saying, okay, how do we assess whether this person is capable of paying these fines?
It's really incumbent upon a judge before resorting to incarcerating someone to question the person about their financial circumstances and to try to determine if they can pay something. Anything, or can they be put on a payment plan? Or in other instances, judges can sometimes simply substitute an alternative to payment of money, such as like community service, that they could resentence the person to do community service instead of having to pay a fine. And it's just a sort of common sense determination about whether or not somebody has the means to pay. And you know, inquiring about, are they employed? Do they have debts? Do they have dependents that they support? But without going through that, as I said, sometimes courts will just resort to imprisoning the person or issuing some type of a warrant for their arrest, which often leads to them being held in custody before they can see a judge who makes a determination that they can't pay this.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rembrandt is with us in Sun Prairie. Rembrandt, hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Your guest mentioned that, okay, somebody can't pay, they get thrown in jail. How long do they stay there? Is it like 7 days and it's mandatory to let them go? Just curious.
Yeah, Rembrandt, I don't know if there's one specific answer to that, John. Does it vary? How long do people in jail in this situation end up staying in jail?
It really depends on the judge, because if a judge sentences someone, or it's not really a sentence, but if they commit someone to jail and say the person has this many days in jail or until the fine is paid, right? So a judge can say 3 days in jail, or if you pay the $500, you can get out. And that's typically the way a judge would structure it. Some jurisdictions will give you credit, a certain amount of money toward the debt you owe for every day that you spend in jail, which is, of course, sort of backwards because the local jail is actually paying to keep you in jail. So the attempt to recover money from the person actually leads to the county just spending more money in an effort to recover a debt that they're never going to be able to recover.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. My response to this is under the umbrella of personal responsibility. I think people who are guilty of nonviolent crimes know that they're breaking the law and they must pay the consequences. Therefore, I wish the state of Wisconsin would give an option to the offenders to work off their fine. For example, you go 80 and a 55 and you get a $172 fine. Maybe you could work 5 hours picking up garbage along the highway. Or something like that. I'd like to see something like that, because then we would have a responsibility toward our, you know, society.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. John, you mentioned that some judges might, in fact, assign a community service project like that as an alternative.
Yes, judges often do look for those alternatives and those options, community service being one of them when somebody can't afford to pay the fine and maybe they're not working. So a judge says, all right, well, then, you know, you have time to do community service. And that's the way they discharge their debt.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We're talking to John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project, talking with him about causes and consequences of people being jailed for non-payment of public fines and court fees. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this yourself or has a family member? If you've worked as a lawyer, have you defended or prosecuted someone for the offense of failure to pay? Has a client of yours been in this situation? Join in with your thoughts, experiences, questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project, talking with him about challenges facing low-income people in the court system, including potentially jail time for failure to pay things like fines and court fees in Wisconsin and around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Michael is with us now in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for talking about this. I think this is something that doesn't frequently get, or a lot of people are unaware of. I just wanted to share, I haven't ended up being personally jailed for a debt owed, thankfully, though I know people who have. But I just wanted to echo the experience of it being so easy to end up trapped in this sort of cycle where maybe you have a small parking ticket that you can't afford. It's an extra expense you're already scraping by, and that turns into a slightly larger parking ticket, which then turns into your plates getting suspended, which then turns into, you know, you still have to pick your kid up from school, and you end up for a ticket for driving while suspended, and then you have to pay that on top of everything else, and it just very quickly becomes a situation that is even harder to get out of than the one you were in previously, where it was a, you know, $20 parking ticket that you couldn't pay.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. John, that refers back to something you mentioned about this cycle of public debt potentially increasing, snowballing. Is there a better way? Is there a solution to that happening where people are still held accountable, but don't end up with what could be seen as an excessive punishment for a traffic fee or a parking fee or what have you?
Well, I think one important aspect of this is that, you know, legislatures and courts should not expect courts to be self-funding, right? They shouldn't impose additional fees on people in addition to a fine that is supposedly, you know, deterring the conduct, but also imposing, you know, excessive surcharges and fees to basically help run the court at minimal expense. The other idea that people often bring up here is to have a sliding scale for fees. Obviously, if somebody is, two people are pulled over for speeding, one of them, as the caller just described, is just scraping by on minimum wage. The other one happens to be a doctor. Should they pay the same fine? Well, the fine won't deter the doctor from speeding down Main Street if he can pay it easily, but it might be too much for the other person to pay, and they might get trapped in debt. So, you know, calibrating the fine or the sanction to the person's actual means could be a good solution to this problem.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Mary is with us in La Crosse, I think, with thoughts along those lines. Mary, hi.
Hi, yes, I was actually, that's exactly what I was calling about, was wondering how much thought had been put into something like paying according to your ability to repay.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Are there legal obstacles there? John, I could see if I'm the doctor in your scenario saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm not getting equal justice if I'm getting paid more than that other person who doesn't have to make as much money. This is unfair.
Well, I would look at it from sort of the opposite perspective, right? The idea of a fine is that it will deter people from engaging in the conduct. And I think that's, we don't treat criminal offenses like, you know, speeding or going through a red light as criminal, but we want to discourage them. So the fine or the sanction really needs to be tailored to what would deter the conduct. And for someone who's making minimum wage, maybe a $50 fine is enough of a deterrent, but somebody making $150,000 a year, not so much. So the idea would, again, be to really tailor the sanction to something that would be meaningful for that person. And I think that really, for most people, I think that would be equal justice.
Thanks again for that call, Mary. John Gross is with us from the UW Law School and the Public Defender Project, looking at people being jailed in some cases, about 8,000 people a year in Wisconsin for non-payment, sometimes inability to pay court fees and public fines. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. John, I want to dig into a related issue that you've mentioned a couple times, public defenders. I think there's an assumption like, okay, you're in court, you're a defendant, you can't afford a lawyer, one will be provided for you, but will it? How does the court system determine, okay, you can't afford a lawyer of your own, so here you go, public defender?
So most states have indigency guidelines, which is basically a formula or a number that says, if you make more than this, you presumably don't qualify for a public defender. If you make less, you do. And not all states have those numbers calibrated very well. I can tell you that in Wisconsin, the threshold for eligibility is set right around the federal poverty guidelines, and that is very low. So basically, there's a lot of people in Wisconsin, for example, who would be eligible for home heating assistance under federal programs, but Wisconsin would tell them that they're not eligible for a public defender. And the other problem with this, where we see really these issues, this snowballing effect come, is that, you know, for many minor offenses like traffic, people aren't in danger of going to jail, so they don't get appointed a public defender, even if they're too poor to hire a lawyer. And so it isn't until much later, when they owe large amounts of debt and a judge is threatening them with putting them in jail, that a lawyer becomes involved and should be appointed to the case. But by then, they've already accrued the debt, and it's kind of too late to unring the bell.
Do you have thoughts on how Wisconsin could revise that system? Is there another state that you would point to and say, yeah, we should do it that way?
Well, I think the best thing for the Wisconsin legislature would be to not really dictate this on a statewide basis, because your ability to hire a lawyer depends not just on your own financial means, but it also depends on the seriousness of the charge and whether or not there are lawyers in that area who can represent you and are willing to represent you that you can hire. So it's a difficult determination to make about who should be getting appointed lawyers and who shouldn't be. And so it's really something that doesn't do well with a cookie cutter, one size fits all approach. I think Wisconsin would be better served by giving judges and the public defender's office more flexibility in making these determinations and allowing them to consider the sort of economic realities of the place where the person is being prosecuted.
That sounds like it leaves a lot at the discretion of a local judge then, and Judge A might have a very different standard than Judge B in the same court or in different parts of the state.
That is true, and that is certainly a concern. But I think people should be aware that the vast majority of people in our criminal courts are actually too poor to hire a lawyer. The numbers suggest at least 80%, maybe even 90% of people who are arrested just simply can't afford a lawyer. And frankly, one of the best ways for judges to figure this out is if the person keeps coming back to court and tells the judge, I can't find a lawyer to represent me. Well, it seems like they're too poor to hire a lawyer, and the judge should consider appointing counsel to represent them in the criminal case.
Time for one more caller. Kylie is with us in Sparta. Kylie, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
Okay, so I'm probably not going to be popular with this, but I actually think there's two parts to this. First of all, I think that the fines right off the bat should be more expensive. So for instance, instead of a speeding ticket, you know, $170-some, whatever, started out at $1,000 minimum, okay? That's going to deter quite a few people from the behavior, okay? Then when you have that price, then you can then look at what you're talking about today. And done doing like community service, you know, half the fine or whatever.
Kylie, thanks for the call. John Heyer finds for better deterrence, Kylie says.
Well, we've been trying this for a long time in the United States. We've been trying to be tougher on crime. We increase fines, we increase fees, we increase the amount of time people spend in jail. But honestly, all of the research in this area shows that at a certain point, it's not a good deterrent. And so I don't think you can find your way out of the typical traffic infraction.
Kylie, thanks for the call. In our last minute, John, you've been working on these issues of the impact of the legal system on low income defendants and people who get fines and fees. Do you get a sense that people in the court community and the legislature are thinking about these things too?
Well, I think we've sort of settled into this sort of pattern where courts are used to assessing all sorts of fees and fines. And every year the legislature seems to come up with a new additional fine or fee that they can inflict on somebody who's convicted of a crime. And of course, people who are convicted of crimes, they're not popular. And so this is sort of a way of a legislature continually imposing a tax on poor people who don't really have a voice to push back against this. And so I think we really need to have a change in thought about this, because all the research, and as this report shows, much of this debt never goes collected. And in fact, the state spends even more money trying to collect it. So just from an economic perspective, it's not a winner. It's not doing the thing it's supposed to do, which is helping offset the cost of prosecution for these offenses.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's John Gross, Clinical Associate Professor of Law at the UW Law School, Director of the Public Defender Project. We talked to him about the risk of jail time for low-income Wisconsinites who are unable to pay public fines or court fees. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Sex education has been the subject of controversy in U.S. schools, with basic questions about how to teach students about their changing bodies, sexual health, birth control, and whether some or all of those topics should be in schools in the first place. Standards can be different from state to state and district to district. Throw in political polarization around education and around social issues, but this could be a tough time to teach sex education. Our next guest wanted to dig into the experience of educators working in this field and recently completed a study where she talked with 55 sex educators from all over the U.S. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how sex ed is and isn't taught in Wisconsin? Are you a student, or are you raising a student currently going through Growth and Development Unit here in Wisconsin or one of our neighboring states? What are your thoughts on what's being taught and how? Are there changes you'd like to see? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Orla Heyman is Assistant Professor of Sociology at UW Oshkosh, where she researches how people are able to navigate contentious health situations, including sex education and abortion. Orla, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Before we dig into your survey, Orla, can you give us some sense of how we treat sex education here in Wisconsin when it comes to statewide standards or lack of same?
Yeah, so one thing that can be kind of confusing about sex education policy in Wisconsin is that sex education is not mandated in the state. But at the same time, HIV and STI education is mandated. And so they have a difference in scope. And just because Wisconsin doesn't mandate sex education, that doesn't necessarily mean that schools can't provide it. So really the only requirement that Wisconsin has is that if you do teach sex education, then it has to stress abstinence until marriage as the best and preferred choice. And in Wisconsin, sex education does not have to include really any information about contraception or consent or healthy relationships. And it doesn't even have to be evidence-based or medically accurate. So it leaves a lot of room for variation in whether young people in Wisconsin are getting sex education at all, and if they are, you know, what they're learning or not learning from these lessons.
So it sounds like there's a lot of leeway for individual school districts, public and private, as to how and whether they deal with these issues.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of these decisions are really made at the local level. So there's, you know, that includes the state government, but also decisions made by school districts or individual schools and school boards.
That's Wisconsin. Do different states do things differently? Do some mandate more specific kinds of sex education?
They do, yeah. A state that is often talked about with sex education is like a state like California, for example. So they require sex education in all of their public, middle, and high schools. And it has to be medically accurate. It has to be culturally appropriate, age appropriate, and it has to cover certain things like covering healthy relationships, for example.
Orla Heyman is with us, assistant professor of sociology at UW Oshkosh. We're talking about sex education in schools, what there is, what there isn't, and a survey she did of sex educators around the country. We'll get to that in just a moment. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences with sex ed in a school recently or in the distant past. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Orla, what made you want to reach out to sex educators around the country for their perspective?
Yeah, it kind of all goes back to a contradiction that I noticed. Policymakers and school boards and parents are actually largely in agreement that we need sex education in schools in order to address things like teen pregnancy and sexually transmitted infections. And at the same time, how we should implement sex education is really hotly contested at every level of society, with all of these stakeholders trying to influence what sex education should look like. You know, should we be stressing the importance of abstinence until marriage as the societal standard? Or maybe we should stress the importance of preventative measures like communication skills or condoms or birth control. And really, sex educators are the people who are on the ground doing this work, and they're responsible for implementing these various curricula. So they're kind of caught in the middle of all this. And it turns out there's actually been very little research that describes what this all means for sex educators and what it's like to navigate this context. So my research was really aimed at understanding current sex education from the perspectives of sex educators themselves. I wanted to compare their experiences and understand what kinds of challenges they face when they're teaching a controversial topic in K through 12 schools.
Now, depending on people's experience, they might remember any sex ed they had might have been taught by the gym teacher or the biology teacher or the teacher who drew the short straw, maybe. What qualifies as a sex educator? Who were you talking to for your study?
Yeah, it's a great question because it can actually, like you said, can include all kinds of people. So the way I defined it is anyone who delivers sexual health instruction in a K through 12 school as part of their job. So that would include both of the groups who really do this work in schools. So that's both teachers, as you mentioned, and also community educators. And so that was one of the kind of innovative parts of this research, because most studies don't actually differentiate between these two groups who are doing this work.
And how often is it teachers versus, and this is interesting, as something you found or talked about a little bit, is outside independent contractors being taught and who might specialize in this kind of education more often? How common is that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we don't know for certain how common it is because there's been no sort of national demographic survey of sex educators. So it's a little bit of guesswork. But one of the things that I found from my interviews with sex educators in different parts of the country is that they are noting that there is, we're undergoing sort of a shift in sex education where it really is increasingly being taught by as you said, outside independent contractors instead of traditional teachers. And so we're talking about community sex educators who work for local community health organizations and come into a school, a classroom to teach sex ed for a limited period of time.
What are the pros and cons as you think about that kind of approach, bringing in somebody maybe more specialized, but maybe they don't know the kids' names?
Yeah, it's a big question. So really, teachers and community educators, I find, can have different kinds of training and background and motivations for teaching sex ed. You know, teachers tend to be great classroom managers, and they know their students. You know, many of them have developed relationships with their students over several years. And of course, they're trained to teach as well. And so those can all be great benefits in the sex ed classroom so that young people feel comfortable covering these topics. On the other hand, though, most teachers have not specifically studied sexual health or how to facilitate these kinds of conversations. And in some cases, you might have a math or a science teacher who's teaching sex ed, and they likely haven't really prepared to do this, and maybe didn't even want to in the first place. There were some sex educators who told me that teaching sex ed for some teachers is considered kind of an undesirable gig. And so sometimes it can go to the least experienced and newest teachers.
Big picture, what kind of challenges and concerns did you hear from the sex educators you talked to?
Yeah, so it really ran the gamut. So one challenge is a lack of time. So from talking to sex educators, it sounds like sex education isn't necessarily given very high priority in the school curriculum. So some places might get a few weeks of sex education, but other places might get just a few days or even just a single, you know, hour-long visit from a sex educator. And so this really puts sex educators in a difficult place, trying to figure out what topics to prioritize when they have very limited time in the classroom. And when sex education is integrated into the health curriculum, as it sometimes is, it then has to compete for time with other health topics like nutrition and fitness and substance use and hygiene and so on, which are also all very important, but it's difficult to figure out how to prioritize those. And some sex educators feel that sex ed comes too late in the curriculum as well. Sometimes they only get to talk to young people after some of them have already become sexually active, or they're only invited into schools after there's been an incident like a sexual assault or a pregnancy. So some of them are frustrated that sex education isn't considered more preventative, and would like to be doing these lessons a little bit earlier.
We're talking about the state of sex education with Orla Heyman, assistant professor of sociology at UW Oshkosh. She recently finished a study that included interviews with 55 sex educators from around the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? If you've ever taught sex education in the schools, how does what you're hearing about match up with your own experience? If you're a parent, if you're a student or a recent student yourself, what do you wish was taught when it came to sex education in your school? Has this ever been a controversial issue in your district or your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Orla Heyman, assistant professor of sociology at UW Oshkosh. We're talking about sex education in Wisconsin and around the country. Orla's sharing some results of a study she recently finished looking at shifts and trends for sex educators and some of the challenges they face trying to do their jobs effectively. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your experiences, a parent, a student, a teacher, yourself. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on a caller now. Carrie is with us in Belleville. Carrie, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to share with us, Carrie?
Well, I have a middle schooler. We're in Belleville, and I've been kind of just taken aback by the lack of just correct information and professionalism of our sex education department. There's a health teacher who teaches to both the middle school and the high school. My son's come back telling me that the teacher can't even say in class or won't anatomical parts, like referred to things as a carrot and a cream-filled donut. But I just like, what kind of education is my son getting at the school if someone is even like embarrassed to, you know, say what, you know,
anatomical terms. I gotcha. Karee, thanks for the call. Orla, is this something you hear either anecdotally or maybe from the people you talk to directly, shying away even from basic anatomical terms?
Yeah, it is actually. And I think, I mean, it can come from a few different places. There's the possibility that there's, you know, a lack of training, especially when teachers are kind of pushed into teaching sex education without some proper education and training for them. But it also has to do with people's comfort levels sometimes. But one of the things that I heard a lot from sex educators, especially in certain parts of the country, is that some of them feel really limited in what they feel they can say or teach in the classroom. So some sex educators told me that they wish that they could teach about condoms, for example, because they know that they have sexually active students in their classes, but they're afraid that if they did, that you know, they're worried they could lose their teaching license over it. Another sex educator told me that they couldn't tell students about their full range of reproductive options if a student was sexually assaulted. And someone else told me a story about a student asking a question in class, and she told them, "Oh, I can't answer that." And the student responded, "Well, isn't that why you're here, to teach us about real life things?" And she said, "Yes, that's absolutely correct," but she doesn't want to lose her job. So some sex educators feel really constrained in what they can say, and they often feel like it's doing a real disservice to young people that they teach.
Karee, thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. And Orla, following up on that point, and presumably teachers watch the news, they might see angry confrontations at school board meetings over sensitive social issues. District administrators see the same things. Are people just kind of gun shy? They don't want to be the next viral controversy if somebody doesn't like the way sex education is taught.
I think some people are. And there's a huge range, definitely. But I heard from some sex educators that some schools are definitely worried about becoming a scandal on their local news, and they don't want that. But really, one of the things that sex educators told me is that they're constantly having to push against these misconceptions about what sex education is. Some people assume that sex education is encouraging young people to have sex, which, you know, sort of stirs up a lot of this controversy. And the sex educators I talked to really did not feel like that accurately portrayed their approach to sex education. For them, they talked a lot about the need to provide young people with information and tools and strategies to make informed decisions. And interestingly, not only did they talk about people having misperceptions about sex education, but that also sometimes has implications for how they are perceived by others as well. So some of them told me that they feel like they're seen as sexual deviants, and in some cases are, you know, accused of being sexual predators even. One sex educator told me about being confronted by an armed parent in a school parking lot who was upset that she was teaching sex education in the school. Another sex educator told me about being labeled a pervert in a local newspaper. So sex educators I talked to felt like they were being perceived as these sexual deviants just for teaching about sexual health.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Daryl is with us in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi.
Okay, well, this I'm calling about what they're bringing up right now and how teachers are expected to teach sex education, but when they do teach it in a practical form in the class, the parents come after them, and like you're just talking about right now, there's been cases where they're labeled as this and that, and they're just trying to do their job. My question is, where are the parents? Where is the parents' involvement in sex education? Why can't they support the teachers and be realistic about, you know, this is what you got to understand about sex. This is the way things work with the human body.
Daryl, thanks for the call. Orla, do you see successful ways to bridge those gaps when the parents don't like the very notion of sex ed, ways that teachers and administrators and parents can somehow still work together?
Yeah, well, and I would also note that really research finds that the vast majority of parents of like middle and high schoolers, for example, support having sex education taught in schools. And actually a majority of those parents support sex education that, you know, teaches about things like condoms and other forms of contraception, for example. There are those who feel more worried about that, and they tend to be sort of loud, but they are actually a minority. And so I think it's important for parents that feel like they want to support sex education in their school and are interested in what's being taught there to really get, you know, talk to principals, talk to superintendents, show up to school board meetings, and make sure that your thoughts on that are known and that they know that parents in the community really support that.
Thanks again for that call. Orla, you're a college professor. You work with students who are just out of high school themselves. What kind of things do you hear from them about the range of sex ed that they've received and their thoughts about what sex ed they received?
Yeah, I teach some classes on sort of sex and sexualities, and often we will talk about sex education at some point during the semester. And as I've been teaching that class, I've been hearing from students who've grown up in Wisconsin, and really one of the things I hear from them a lot is a sense of betrayal, really, feeling like they maybe weren't actually supported in a way that they, you know, found helpful or sufficient for them in their sex education. And especially as we start talking about what sex education can look like in other places, when they realize that the way that it's done in Wisconsin isn't necessarily the only way and isn't the way that it's done elsewhere, they get a little angry about it, honestly, a little indignant.
And just our last less than a minute, Orla, what do we lose if we don't have quality sex education?
Yeah, I think that it really comes down to people's sexual health in the end. So if we want sort of low teen pregnancy rates, if we want low rates of STIs, for example, we need to sort of be talking about these things and in a way that doesn't make people feel sort of ashamed or shut down. And really recent trends reported by the CDC show that sexual activity has actually been declining among young people since 2011. But when they are sexually active, they're less likely to use condoms. And also their experiences of sexual violence have also increased, especially for female high school students. So including lessons about contraception, including condoms, and also about things like sexual violence and consent are really, really important.
Orla, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for sharing your research with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Orla Heyman, Assistant Professor of Sociology at UW Oshkosh. We talked to her about sex ed policy in Wisconsin and a recent study looking at shifts and challenges for sex educators around the country. We'll be right back. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Lately, we hear different entertainers talk about how precarious their industry is nowadays and their fears of saying the wrong thing and getting canceled or otherwise vilified for their work. There's also talk about how show business used to be much more open and free and that people now have become too sensitive and restrictive over what people should and shouldn't say or do. Turns out this is not a new thing. Entertainers have been feeling this way for generations. Here are TV personalities and comedians Fred Allen and Steve Allen talking about the industry in a 1955 NBC show reflecting on comedian Will Rogers.
I think the people today are in the humor field their limits are much greater than Will's were, because Will could talk about anything politically or any phase of life in our country, and the people accepted it in the humor in which he delivered it. But today we have a great many pressure groups and a great many self-appointed people who are ready to criticize without being ready to help, you know.
These are very touchy times.
Those are quoted in our guest's new book about how the cultural response to entertainment has changed and some of the themes that have remained the same over time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you seen our standards change for what is culturally acceptable in our entertainment? Were you glad to see those changes, or do you think we lost something? Are there certain topics you've seen people get more or maybe less upset about over time? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Cliff Nesteroff is an author and comedy historian who writes about comedy in the entertainment industry. His latest book is called Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. Cliff, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I absolutely love that clip you played. I thought it was just incredible.
Credit to our producer, Lauren, for digging up that clip. But we knew about it from your book, and it really illustrates. That's about a 70-year-old clip, and these things that I think we think are new, cancel culture or woke entertainment industry arguments, things like that, they've been around since way before 1955. This has a long history. Can you talk about what led you into digging into that history?
Well, whenever I hear this refrain that you can't say anything anymore, it just seems to be contradictory when you look at the actual evidence. That clip is from 1955, and the two things that were happening in America at that time period, on the left side of things and on the right side of things, were McCarthyism on the right side of things and the burgeoning civil rights movement on the left-wing side of things. So Brown versus Board of Education was 1954. That clip was 1955. McCarthyism was at its height at that moment. And so you had these two sort of elements that were jockeying to suppress different things for different reasons. And one of the cliches you hear today on talk radio and cable news is that it used to be the right-wingers that tried to suppress and censor, the Jerry Falwells and the Pat Robertsons, and that today it's the opposite. It's the left-wingers on college campuses that are trying to suppress things. But the reality is that both occur concurrently at all times. So, like I mentioned, in the 1950s, you have the civil rights movement on one end trying to remove racial stereotypes and books like Little Black Sambo from schools and trying to eliminate the last vestiges of blackface that were still around. And on the other hand, you had people on the right that were trying to suppress things that criticized American foreign policy or American history, tried to suppress things that, were of a more critical or progressive point of view. Criticism of religion was very much taboo in those days. So when I look at the history of show business and the history of comedy, it seems obvious to me that we have more freedom of speech today, not less. Compare what you can say today on satellite radio and podcasts to what you could not say for the entire existence of AM and FM radio. Compare what you can say on cable television or streaming services to what you could not say and still can't say on network TV, ABC, CBS, NBC. You can swear now, you can criticize things politically now, you can criticize religion now, and you can express sexuality now. All of those things would have gotten you in severe trouble in the past. And I don't just mean people getting upset, but comedians would get arrested if they swore on stage for a century. Things didn't really start to change until the 1970s. And even then, on network TV and traditional radio, you still couldn't swear. So I would say there are less taboos today, not more, even though there are some taboos, most of which are focused on what people consider to be bigotry. And sometimes it is bigotry, and sometimes it's just the perception of bigotry. But that's where the majority of taboos today lie, is in the realm of bigotry.
And we think of, at least in political punditry, the concept of culture war seems to have come up and gotten to be a big phrase in the United States just over the last couple few, maybe decades. But it seems like you see that battle over culture and how it's presented in our popular media as going back, again, 150 plus years.
Yes, the phrase is new, but the concept isn't. And for me, I sort of see the culture war as not merely about the culture, but exploiting the culture for political reasons. So, for instance, a politician will exploit religion. They will claim to be a good Christian and their opponent is some sort of heathen when the politician, this hypothetical politician, is exemplifying all the sins, whether it be adultery, whether it be lying, whether it be fraud, you know. So these sort of cultural markers are used to exploit and to divide. And that was true going back decades. Certainly McCarthyism was a 1950s version of the culture war, a way to demonize your political adversary, marginalize them, and to acquire political power for oneself. And that is still what we see with the culture war. It really is about eliminating the opponent, eliminating the adversary, and acquiring and retaining power by exploiting people's fears, by exploiting people's beliefs. That essentially is what the culture war is all about.
Talking to Cliff Nesteroff about his new book. It's called Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. You can join in with your thoughts on these issues or your questions at 800-642-1234. So many moments in your book, Cliff. I want to go back to vaudeville, and this might surprise people. A lot of protests from Irish-American groups, I think German-American, Jewish-American groups, African-American groups, criticizing their portrayal on the vaudeville stage. Talk to us a little bit about that era.
Yes. Well, in the 1890s and the early 1900s, ethnic characterizations were very, very common. In fact, the idea of a malapropism, which we see today still in characters like Borat or Ali G, the idea of somebody mangling the English language and getting a laugh by saying a word that sounds similar to the word they mean, but having a different definition. That whole concept really begins in vaudeville, and you had all these sort of parodies of various immigrant groups. Immigration was at a high point in the 1870s, the 1880s, and the 1890s, and the new arrivals were the ones that were parodied on the vaudeville stage, whether it was Jewish immigrants, Irish immigrants, Italian immigrants. It was very common to see what now we would consider stereotypes being portrayed on the stage. But as these immigrant groups started to become assimilated, and as they had children, and as those children grew up to be adults, they had less patience for being ridiculed on the vaudeville stage. And there were a number of protest movements that emerged in the late 1890s and the early 1900s, objecting to what they considered slanderous portrayals on the stage. And so there was a group called the Clan na Gael. They were an Irish betterment group. They were not as militant as the IRA or the Molly Maguires, but I think they were certainly inspired to a certain degree by those militant protest movements. They objected to people on the stage making fun of Irish people or putting on a thick accent or doing a little jig, you know, all the common Irish stereotypes that were not necessarily performed with malice, but they were not performed with any real footing in reality either. And the Clan na Gael objected to this, and they asked vaudeville theater managers to stop booking Irish stereotype comedians. Theater managers, vaudeville bookers said, no, I mean, people enjoy this type of comedy. You need to get a sense of humor, and we're not going to stop doing this. And the Clan na Gael said, well, if you don't, we're going to take matters into our own hands, which is exactly what they did. Wherever Irish stereotype comedy was performed, soon shows were sabotaged. People would storm the stage, stomp their feet, blow whistles, drown out the comic, boo the comic, throw things at the stage. And this continued for several years until vaudeville theater managers realized, well, this is just not worth the trouble, and they did start to eliminate Irish stereotypes from the stage. Now, there were several newspaper editorials written at the time. We're talking about 1902, 1903, 1904. Several newspaper editorials saying this is terrible for the state of comedy, the state of free speech. How dare these people try and bully us into what we can and cannot say. Other newspaper editorials defended them and said, well, maybe it is time that we get rid of some of these stereotypes and try a new form of comedy. But a lot of the editorials said, you know, what's next if we buckle to Irish protest groups? What's going to happen? Are black patrons going to object to blackface? Then what? It'll be the death of comedy. And they sounded the alarm. And it did inspire other groups to protest. Italian immigrant groups were tired of seeing themselves being portrayed as organ grinders, saying Mamma Mia on the stage, and that eroded. And bit by bit, these protest movements had some effect. And just like today, there was this debate about whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, but it did contribute to the evolution of vaudeville comedy at the time.
We're talking to author and comedy historian Cliff Nesteroff about his new book. It's called Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of different kinds of protests, about content in comedy, on stage, on the screen? What changes have you seen in your lifetime between what the culture at large views as acceptable in entertainment, maybe what you yourself view as acceptable or otherwise? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. That's The Twist by Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, later covered by Chubby Checker. You might think of it as an old-timey dance where you rotate your midsection back and forth, as instructed by the lyrics. Back when it was first released in 1959, it was seen as so provocative and controversial, it was banned in cities, even countries around the world. It's an example of how the public battle over what's socially acceptable in entertainment has changed over time. We're talking about that with our guest Cliff Nesteroff, author of the new book, Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's turn to the mid-1900s again. Actually, Cliff, you see an organized campaign by groups like the John Birch Society, started here in part in Wisconsin, and others targeting degrading forms of entertainment, including The Twist.
Sure. I mean, The Twist was considered real salacious when it came out, that it was some sort of a demonstration of sexuality on the dance floor. And the fact that young people, teenagers, took to it was considered very alarming to older people. But this had been an old argument going back to the teens, at the days of the tango and the foxtrot. Even the waltz was considered somewhat salacious. And dancing was really a controversial issue throughout American history, the Calvinist influence and the various sort of puritanical influences were very much opposed to dancing in general. They considered it an avenue to sexuality, which in a way it was. But if you look at The Twist, I mean, it's so quaint compared to twerking. But the sort of controversy that surrounded it, it was very similar to many of the controversies throughout history. And a lot of that controversy was had a religious basis. It was sort of the pulpit that was objecting to these things and claiming that it was contributing to the downfall of America. And I have a line in the opening of the book where I talk about how throughout American history, and this is still true today, people always think that things are much worse today than they were in the past. And people often mistake change for decline. And you still see that happening today. And there's always this sort of doomsday prophecy. And today it's not coming from preachers. It's coming from secular commentators, or at least people who purport to be secular. I think there is an evangelical influence behind it, claiming that things have never been so bad in the culture and that things used to be better. But the same arguments that existed that exist today existed back then.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I believe that in America we've lost our sense of humor. And what I mean by that is, in Canada, I live near the border up here, so I get a couple radio programs from Canada that are hilarious. And I don't know anybody that listens to the radio or has an American radio program that they listen to and laugh at. I think we've lost radio as an influence in our culture.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. I think a lot of people laugh at me more than with me anyway, but thanks a lot for the call, Jeff. But Cliff, radio comedy was big once upon a time. And actually, one of the examples you give in the book, Stan Freberg, who had a radio show, albums, and a book, was one of those figures that became controversial after being targeted. Can you talk a little bit about his story?
Yeah, well, his book was an autobiography that was written years later, but in the 1950s, at the height of Stan Freberg's popularity, he was a well-known satirist. He didn't consider himself a comedian, per se. He certainly considered himself specifically a satirist. He would parody things like the Harry Belafonte Calypso craze and Lawrence Welk and a number of other things. But he had several records that were banned. And frequently, when he appeared on TV, and he was very popular, he was censored. He wanted to do a sketch about cigarette smoking and the idea that doctors, 9 out of 10 doctors, were recommending cigarettes. Well, that was taboo in American culture. In the 1950s, the sponsors yielded a lot of power, both on radio and television. And whatever the sponsor didn't want on the air, it didn't happen. That has changed drastically today with streaming services. You know, with the Dave Chappelle controversy and Netflix, Netflix can afford to not buckle to protest because there's no advertising on their platform. Whereas if Dave Chappelle had done his same routines on a network show that had commercials, people who objected could then target the advertiser, and then you would see something be removed or censored. So in the days when commercial sponsors really controlled comedy, Stan Freberg frequently came into discord with his intent and what the sponsors wanted, which was to offend absolutely nobody. And of course, satire always has a target, so it is going to ruffle some sensibilities. Ultimately, Stan Freberg became so frustrated with the fact that he was frequently being censored on American television in the 1950s, he got an offer from a TV producer in Toronto who said, "Why don't you come up to Canada? We'll let you do all the material that's been censored by network television." And this included comedy that parodied bigots in the South who were opposed to integration in schools, and the aforementioned cigarette smoking routine.
That goes back to Canada for you there, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Cliff Nesteroff is with us. His book is Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars. And Cliff, mentioning race, through decades and decades, one of the things that people got offended about was the presence of a black entertainer where white people might see or hear them, or black and white people together on a stage or soundstage, as the case may be. How much protest and boycott and even violence did that lead to?
Well, it depends on which era and which part of the country we're talking about and which situation. But black performers were welcome on what you might call a white stage back in the day. But there were sort of differences in and expectations in terms of quote-unquote manners in those days. So, for instance, a black performer could perform for a white audience, but they were not allowed to address the audience. A black performer on the stage could not look down at the white audience and say, "Hello, sir, where are you from?" That was considered taboo, and that was also considered a grounds to be fired if you were a black comic. And that stood strong for several decades. It wasn't until the post-war period that that started to change ever so slightly. There was a comedian completely forgotten today named Timmy Rogers. And Timmy Rogers was one of the first black comedians to address white audiences. Up to that point, most black comics dressed in a costume. They were very broad. They used a fake name like Baby Seals or Pig Meat. Timmy Rogers went on stage using his own name, dressed in his own clothes, and he performed at a place called the Beverly Hills Country Club, which was actually in Kentucky. It was a mafia-run nightclub. And when he went on stage in his regular clothes and started to address the audience, the mafia objected. They said, you cannot act like a white person on stage. How dare you? They fired him. He was not booked there again. That was in 1948 or 49. Dick Gregory came along in the early 1960s at the height of the civil rights movement, and he sort of broke the mold. He went on stage in front of white audiences in San Francisco and talked about the civil rights movement. And because there was so much tension in America at the time regarding school integration, voting registration, you know, all the civil rights actions that were occurring at the time, it was like a big valve that opened. And to hear a black comedian make fun of racists on stage was incredibly cathartic in the early 1960s. So from then on, from the moment that Dick Gregory became popular, that started to change. And for the first time, you started to see a lot of black comedians being booked in white nightclubs, performing for white audiences. But up until that point, it had been largely taboo. And a lot of the controversies surrounding rock and roll were also related to race and racism and so-called race mixing. The idea of black kids and white kids dancing together totally upset and frustrated their parents, older racists, who really objected to this. So a lot of the objections to rock and roll and to the dance crazes that came about had to do with the mixing of black and white people.
And we'll leave it there. Cliff, thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Cliff Nesteroff, author, comedy historian who writes about comedy in the entertainment industry. We've been talking about his new book, Outrageous, A History of Showbiz and the Culture Wars.